Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Marque son équipe ne perd jamais. C'était le cas avec City, c'est le cas avec Arsenal. 58 matchs, il a marqué et son équipe n'a pas perdu. Kétia, Kai Havertz et Kai Havertz de s'enthousiasmer et de marquer son premier but ici à l'Emirates en Première Ligue. Kai Havertz, superstar.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you, man. How you doing?
I'm good. I've got some freshly brewed coffee here and I'm ready for some SFA.
Now, what's that? The Scottish Football Association?
No, no. Superb football analysis.
Lovely.
I was going to say serious football analysis, but that would be a complete misnomer when it comes to this show.
SFA. Yeah, I was thinking, what? Didn't we win an SFA award once upon a time?
That was the FSA award.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes, but we could also
Football
win
serious an award. Yeah,
we could win an award for SFA anytime.
Sweet fuckle.
Yeah, there or thereabouts. But look, we're heading into the Christmas period and Arsenal are top of the table after a very good win over Brighton yesterday, and after what was a good weekend, I think, in general terms, when it comes to some of the other results that happened, and, you know, the game between Liverpool and Manchester United yesterday was the one everyone was waiting on to be the big fixture of the day, and it was, of course, as is often the case, a big bag of shit. Mm-hmm. And Manchester City dropped points to Crystal Palace on Saturday, which was good news as well. So,
good news all round, yeah. I think, from an Arsenal perspective. I mean, you would have, I'm sure everyone would have had City and Liverpool as winning those two games.
Mm.
Particularly with United in the form they've been in, it was more a question of how many is it going to be. So, yeah, really, really good outcome. And Arsenal's fixture was not an easy one.
You know,
as much as Palace have been City's sort of bogey team at home, Brighton have really been ours, I think.
Yeah.
I don't mean to sort of downplay their quality by describing them in that way, but they've given us a lot of problems at home. Obviously, there was a really painful result against them back in May.
Yeah.
So this was great. I loved it. Really, really loved this game. Loved this performance.
All right. Well, you know, we've got plenty to delve into here, but just to make people aware, it's 11:07. The Champions League knockout draw is taking place as we speak. So we will react to it when the draw is made. We're not watching because Andrew Allen has just sent me a message saying, John Terry doing the draw, horrible. So we're not
missing
anything.
If the draw's just started now, obviously we record for about 90 minutes typically, there's a chance we might know the result by the end of the podcast.
Yes.
I'm on Copenhagen. I'm all in on Copenhagen.
Okay, I'm sort of open to any of the adventures that we've got because it's nice to be in there. But I prefer not to get PSG at this point. We will see. And like I said, we will react to this. So look, you said you loved this game.
Loved it.
And I have to say, I think there was a lot to like about the way Arsenal played yesterday. In no small part, because I think Brighton played pretty well. I know they had a few little oopsies around the penalty area when they were doing their playing out from the back. But there were other times where they were very brave, played good football, tried to get it up the field, you know, played it around under pressure while we were chasing them around. And, you know, we know what they're about. We know what kind of threat they can be. And I think, you know, we have to look at this. We have to look at this Arsenal performance in the context of what Brighton are capable of doing, what they did defensively, how they've hurt us in the past before. And, you know, from the very start of this game, I think the intent was clear, wasn't it? As soon as the game kicked off, Arsenal pressed high up the pitch, you know, four players, five players going, and it set the tone for the performance that we were able to put in.
Yeah, we went after them. And it's a brave thing to do against Brighton because they can really play. I mean, I think they ended the game just about edging the possession, 51%. I think they completed more passes than Arsenal in the game. But a lot of that was in their own defensive third because they couldn't progress past us. And you're absolutely right. We flew out of the blocks. Could have scored in the first minute. Could have scored again, you know, within the first 5 minutes. And that would sort of become the story of the first half, really, how we conspired to not score. But I thought the intensity of our performance was brilliant. I thought we really attacked the game. And Brighton, as you say, are an awkward, awkward team who are used to, as De Zerbi said afterwards, controlling games. He was like, you know, normally wherever they go, home or away, there's a decent chance they're in control of proceedings, but they weren't here. And as he put it, they suffered. And we put that suffering on them with a really, really, really good performance.
Yes. Yeah. And there is a discussion, I think, to be had about attacking efficiency, right? Mikel Arteta spoke about that ahead of this game. He said, you've got to be efficient. And we could see that that was a theme maybe last week against Aston Villa where chances weren't taken. Mm-hmm. And we had a number of questions about this, but I sort of want to get into it with you. Like, how do you... Look, it's clear that when you're looking to bounce back from defeat, right? You're playing against the team that have given you a hard time at home, and you go in at halftime, it's 0-0, and you've taken 15 shots, and there have been chances to score goals, and you haven't scored those goals. To what extent are you able to balance that frustration, I think, that comes with that, which is obvious frustration because, you know, 15 shots, no goals, you need to be a little bit more efficient than that. But with what you've seen with your eyes and the way that the team has played and the way that they have in the final third caused Brighton all kinds of problems. I think better decision-making a couple of times, maybe being a little bit quicker a couple of times, just a little more control on one or two of the finishes a couple of times. And we're going in at halftime and it's 2-0, maybe 3-0, you know? So how do you balance that frustration of not scoring with, you know, I find it, I have to say, I find it more of a cause for optimism than concern when we play the way we do, even if we haven't scored the goals, because I think there's much more to worry about if you are a team that huffs and puffs and just can't make any chances and can't find a way behind a defense that's set up to try and stop you. You know, keeper's made some saves, they've made a load of blocks, et cetera, that... You know, for me, I would love to see a score, a couple of goals in that first half, of course. But it was a question for me of like, well, if you keep plugging away like this, you know, the goals will come.
Yeah, my glass is also kind of half full about it. Whether that would have been the case had, was it Gross, you know, turned that ball just into the goal rather than the side netting.
Champions League draw, Porto.
Of course. I feel like we're that was always kind of in the ether, wasn't it?
Right.
Porto. But listen, in football terms, I think that's a pretty decent draw for us.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's maybe not the most exciting of the trips, but I gather Porto's quite a nice place. But football-wise, I think that's pretty good.
Okay. We'll have some time to ponder on that and maybe talk about it a little bit
more. I look forward to Copenhagen in the final. you know, maybe a two-leg semi-affair. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
So, what was I saying? I mean, there have been times, you know, I know you spoke about it being a concern if your team is sort of ponderous and struggling to create chances. I think it would be unfair to kind of characterise Arsenal in that way at any point this season. But the attack and the fluency of the attack, the ability to create chances, has been a talking point, right, for much of the season. And I think that this was our best attacking Premier League performance so far. I think I do think that, actually. When you consider the quality of the opposition, I think it's right up there.
Mm.
I know that we didn't necessarily get the end product that you might look for in that situation, but I think we were helped slightly by the fact that it was Brighton and the type of football they play. You know, they play like a big team. They play a bit like a Champions League team. And to a certain extent, that suits Arsenal. But I really thought that we looked lively, inventive, creative. Maybe the finishing is not quite there. It's interesting. If you look back at last season, I think the stats kind of show that we ran pretty hot in terms of finishing, particularly in the first half of the campaign. You know, we overperformed in front of goal to a certain extent. We're not doing that right now. But I think that sort of, like you, it gives me a bit of hope because it makes me think when we do turn a corner and we're at the point when the finishing really does hit form and, you know, we're taking chances you wouldn't ordinarily expect us to.
Yeah.
There ought to be a lot there for us because we're very good value for our wins at the present point in time.
I think that's absolutely fair. And, you know, there were moments where in that first half, I think we should have scored. That Martinelli chance, I know it maybe looks a little easier than it is. And I can see what he's trying to do with the finish there.
Yeah. What a pass from Odegaard, by
unbelievable. When you look at, the more you look at that pass, the better it gets.
The ball almost seems to have backspin on it as it lands.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost, he kills it as well as, he has the force on it to play it through the gap. And then he just manages, the ball just dies for Saka. It's incredible.
There's this amazing clip of, I think it was from the Ryder Cup, actually, Rory McIlroy.
Right.
And he plays this chip shot from, I don't know, 30 yards, 40 yards like that. And the ball takes a bounce and you're going, oh, that's going to go miles past the hole. It takes another bounce just beyond the hole, maybe like a foot, and then just stops. And the Martin Odegaard pass kind of reminded me of that in the way that it sort of had the pace to get beyond, but then sort of span back into the path of Bukayo Saka. It's just an unbelievable pass from Odegaard. Saka laid it back, and then Martinelli, I think he was just trying to cushion it into the top corner, but just got a little bit too much on it.
I think he thinks he has to lift it because I think he probably anticipates that defender sliding to block.
Mm.
I mean, I think the way the ball comes back to Saka probably even deceives him. I think when Saka runs through, he's thinking, I'm going to the byline here, so I've got to pull it back. But actually, the way the ball slows down into his path, there's not really any reason he can't take that on himself.
Yeah.
He looks back for Martinelli and, yeah, he kind of skies it, doesn't he? But yeah, I was just sort of still mouth agape at that pass from Martin Odegaard.
Gabriel Jesus had some shots. Gabriel had a header on target. Odegaard curled a shot wide.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what else there was. There was a very good chance for Martinelli to square the ball to Bukayo Saka when he ran through and just kept going, and the angle got tightened a little bit. And I know we've spoken a bit about Martinelli. We spoke about him on last week's show, and I don't really want to do that whole thing again, but we did have a slew of questions about Martinelli's decision-making and things like that. What did you make of his performance yesterday? Because there was so much to like about it. You know, there was so much direct running. There was so much pace, the way he stretched that Brighton defence. You know, both fullbacks that he came up against, the guy who went, nah, I'm not having this, I'm going off in the first half. I guess he's injured, really. Veltman. They brought on Hinshelwood, I think it was. But, you know, he sort of terrorised those defenders. But again, once he got into the key positions, maybe the decisions weren't quite right.
That's bang on.
Yeah.
I think decision making. And actually, I think when you're flying as a player, it's almost as if you're not really making decisions.
Mm.
It all happens quite automatically. And maybe, you know, just because, you know, the end product hasn't necessarily been there from this season, there is that bit of forethought. There is that hesitation, that slight overcomplication that can occur. But his threat is still so considerable. And I think he was such a part of what Arsenal were doing off the ball as well. That again, I'm more inclined to be positive about his performance than negative.
Yes.
I know there was some frustration with him, particularly when it was still only 1-0 and you thought, is this game in the balance? But I have to hope it will come for him, because 9/10 of it, he's doing so well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bukayo Saka as well. Look, there's been a lot more end product from Bukayo Saka, but in this game, there were perhaps moments where he could have done better. I'm thinking there's one late in the first half where it falls to his right foot and he blasted it over the bar. You know, if we're talking about attacking efficiency, it wasn't just Martinelli, but I do think there were probably clearer moments for Martinelli to make an impact. Like, there was that one I talked about where he ran through. If he just played the ball across, sometimes you see these like snapshots or a freeze frame. I put one on the blog today. And you go like, well, if he'd only played that pass between seven defenders, he would have found the guy at the back post. But like Saka, there was nobody there. He just needed to roll it across to Saka for a tap in, and he carried on. And there was a moment, maybe it was just after that, where he beat the defender and he could have got the ball across, but then cut back and tried to beat him again and lost it. Like, I don't know that you have to beat the defender twice. So maybe just there's something in the way that he's feeling in terms of his own confidence or self-confidence, I'm not sure. Trying to do a bit much.
Psychology, isn't it? But I think, you know, maybe he's also looking at his own numbers and, you know, there's a determination to kind of improve upon those. And maybe that influences the choices he's making on the field. I'd sort of hesitate to say he's being selfish. I think that would be wrong. I actually think he does a lot of unselfish work for the team. And I think fundamentally, the position that he plays, holding the width, is a very team-oriented role.
Yeah,
it reminds me a bit of Thierry Henry at Barcelona being told by Pep Guardiola, you need to stand by the touchline until we get to the final third, then you can have a bit of freedom. And I almost think, you know, Arteta kind of applies the same principle with Martinelli. So I've got great respect for him for doing that for the team. But yeah, maybe once he gets there, there's just that added thing of like, oh, I need to get a shot off here. I need to start getting the goals. Who knows? It's that paradox, isn't it, where we talk about choices and decisions, but when a player is on top of their game, they're not even making them. You know,
yeah, that's
it's all just
true.
Happening.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I have to give him some credit as well for the set-piece delivery. The corners he was putting in from that side were excellent all day. And very dangerous and difficult for Brighton to defend against. And we might talk about Brighton's defending as well. But first half, you know, 15 shots to Arsenal. Mikel Arteta is booked for waving at Gabriel Martinelli. I'm not sure about that.
What was Arteta signalling there? I didn't have a great view of it.
He seemed to be just sort of waving at the ref because Ben White had been booked a few minutes previously for a similar sort of foul on Mitoma. I think it was Mitoma, wasn't it?
That was a counter-attack foul, wasn't it? It was like just killing a counter-attack.
I think that's fair. And I think it was a booking. And I don't know. Was it like a bad pass? We tried to take a quick free kick, I think, and the ref made us go back.
Right.
And then Zinchenko took it, and I'm not sure if White was ready for the pass. Mitoma intercepted, and then he made the foul. This was a little bit different because it was Bukayo Saka going back towards his own goal. It wasn't a counter-attack, but it was the same foul, you know? So I think Arteta was waving at the referee to sort of, look, if that's
call his attention politely.
Exactly.
Matter at hand.
Exactly. And this is just sort of part of how animated he gets on the sideline. It was quite funny. You can see when the referee comes over and gives him the yellow card, like he is trying so hard to keep his face expressionless.
Yeah.
when you watch the replays of it, it's really quite funny.
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty animated at that moment. I think the whole crowd were quite animated about that foul because it wasn't the first foul on Bukayo Saka. Surprise, surprise. I think there'd been a number of challenges on him. And while I don't think any were a booking in their own right, from what I saw, listen, I was in the crowd, no benefit of replays. You know, there was that sort of cumulative frustration of like, how long is this going to go on before someone gets yellow card?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Milner one was potentially a yellow, you know?
Right.
But certainly there were a couple of moments, weren't there? Lallana went into Odegaard early on, and there were a few bits and bobs from Brighton where, you know, it could have added up to a yellow. But I suppose the other thing about the first half, did you see the tiny shin pad?
No. Who's tiny shin pad?
I think it's the guy Hinshelwood. At one point, there was a tackle. I'm going to send you something here. Will I send it here or on WhatsApp, which is easy?
WhatsApp's best, probably.
All right. So the referee goes to hand him his shin pad, and it is the tiniest. I don't know what it is. I've never seen anything like it.
Oh, wow.
It's a really tiny little shin pad.
It's barely crisp-sized.
I know, yeah. It's like a sort of Pringle or something.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I know footballers, you know, are sometimes a bit... Shin pads have got smaller, certainly, over the years.
I was going to ask you this. Have you noticed there was... I can't remember what game I was watching the other day. There was a game where... can't remember which player it was now. But basically, it didn't look like he was wearing any shin pads at all. And his socks were rolled pretty far down. You know the way Grealish kind of has his socks down a bit?
Yeah.
But even lower than that. And it didn't look like he was wearing shin pads at all.
I think it might be in the laws that you have to.
I think you have to. So maybe this little teeny tiny thing.
This is the latest trend.
But I think, you know, given some of the tackles that have gone in this weekend, I think if I was a player, I would want shin pads. Surely you can have reasonable shin pads that are light enough not to cause you any bother these days, you know?
Sure. I'd be having my shins reinforced with titanium or something. Under the skin.
Yeah.
Never be without them.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
City got Copenhagen. Of course they bloody did.
Oh, did they?
Of course they bloody did.
Right. Let me just have a quick look and see what else is going on in that draw. It is RB Leipzig against Real Madrid, Copenhagen, Manchester City, Lazio, Bayern Munich, PSV, Borussia Dortmund. That's tasty. Inter, Atletico Madrid, PSG versus... Oh, I said it's PSV versus Dortmund, not PSG. PSG versus Real Sociedad. Napoli, Barcelona, and Porto versus Arsenal. So,
where are Manchester United?
Or Newcastle?
Yeah, no sign. No sign.
That's a bit strange.
I halftime was very much... The chat in the concourse was very much, how the hell have we not scored?
Yeah. I can imagine.
It's worth saying, you know, that there obviously are two sides to it, and Brighton didn't really have a sniff. You know, it was a very controlled performance in that respect. We really kept them... You know, I think they've scored in, 31 consecutive games heading into this one. And I thought defensively we kept them really quiet.
Well, that's true. You know, they didn't really have a sniff. They didn't have a shot. You know, when you consider who they've got in their team as well, you know, players who've been so effective and so exciting, you know, Kari Mutoma, Evan Ferguson. Like when Evan Ferguson was taken off, I went, oh, yeah. Evan Ferguson was playing.
He didn't have a sniff.
Really didn't have a sniff. And I think, you know, we'll probably talk about a couple of players who stood out, but William Saliba and Gabriel at the back just did not give him a sniff all game. Brighton tried to find him and they would just follow him into midfield, take the ball, nick the ball, and we would go again. So I think, you know, we ought to give the centre halves their flowers this morning, because while they weren't necessarily tested too much from a defensive point of view, what they did to negate Brighton's attacking threat was really important.
Yeah, I think their willingness to press high as well you know, they're quite brave. And I suppose the athleticism of their partners and teammates enables them to take these kind of risks. But they will push up very, very high to win the ball. They've got no qualms about coming, you know, 30, 40 yards from the opposition goal to close down a centre forward and nick the ball off him. And it's very, very difficult for a striker playing up against them. Physically, they're so intimidating and so good. I thought they were excellent yesterday. And actually, you know, when you're watching a game, certain players just catch your eye, and there are obvious ones who no doubt we'll talk about. But I thought Gabriel had a really, really good game. And I just sort of was watching him thinking, obviously Saliba gets a lot of plaudits. And I think the fact he's so composed and so sort of statuesque, is that what I mean?
No, you don't mean statuesque.
What do I mean?
You mean Saliba, like, so... what do you mean? I know what you mean, but I'm trying to find the word. I understand completely what you're saying, that he is so...
I don't mean that he's still.
No.
Do you know what I mean? I mean that he's, like, imposing and dignified in some way.
Yes.
You get the idea.
Yes.
The fact that he is who he is means he takes a lot of the focus and attention. But I was really struck by Gabriel yesterday and sort of thought, you know, we are very, very lucky to have him as well. And I think it's that partnership that's so crucial.
Commanding? Would that be
commanding? Yeah, that would work for
sure.
That
would work. That would work. But I think, you know, that partnership is so impressive. And it is a big part of what this team is about now, you know. For all the spotlight on others, they really are brilliant, and long may they last. So look, second half kicks off. You say the talk is, well, geez, we should have got a goal. Mm-hmm. Brighton made mistakes a couple of times early in that second half, and I'm pretty sure that was not in Roberto De Zerbi's halftime team talk. There were a couple of mistakes playing out from the back, and that's what they do. You know, that's how they play, and that's the way that they're going to play. Maybe we should have made more after, I think it was the one that leads to the corner. Perhaps yeah. Odegaard could take that with his right foot rather than taking a touch. But from the corner, we get the goal. A lot of chat about, you know, Arsenal need a different number nine. They need a different kind of forward and all that. And you see that discussion happening a lot. But our number nine got us the goal that got us ahead in this game. And I think he was absolutely superb yesterday, Gabriel Jesus. Mm-hmm. We can talk, or people can talk, about how many goals he scores and should he score more. And I know that it's not a one-man team or anything like it, but I think he is just so important to us when we're in that kind of mood and when we're playing that kind of football, that I don't know that there is another centre forward that would enable the fluency that we get in attack with him there, who could also score us more goals. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. I mean, a lot of people at half-time, you know, I spoke about the conversations in the concourses, number nine and centre forward was one of those conversations. Because people are looking at a team and saying, well, we've got everything but the goal here. You know, if only we had an Erling Haaland or maybe even an Ivan Toney, someone to stick the ball in the net. But I'm with you. I think that Jesus is so integral to everything we do. But I think it's great that he scored the goal that he did yesterday. Like, it's kind of a free goal for a centre forward, you know? Like, you stand on the back post at a corner, the ball goes all the way through, you've got an open net and you score. Like, Harry Kane made a career out of scoring those goals. I know he scored other goals as well, but he probably got 10 a season like that. Just wait on the back post on a set piece. And if Jesus can do those bits, those sort of less glamorous, you know, slightly dirtier bits of centre forward play, well, often they're very glamorous. You know, you get all the credit for scoring the goal, but often they're a bit more straightforward. If he can do those, then we'll be in a really good position, because this is a poacher's goal, you know, and it's exactly what we needed. And it breaks the deadlock, and it's the difference on the day, really.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, it's I said, I'm not going to say it's a difficult thing to do to just stand at the back post, but when you look at the way the Arsenal players run across into the middle to take all those defenders with them, something went wrong for Brighton there. You know, something went wrong with Brighton's organisation, because I think it's Havertz who drags a couple of defenders across with him. Jesus is there, gets flicked on, and Jesus, you know, heads in, and it's 1-0. And I think the timing of that goal was particularly important as well. You know, after that first half where we were so dominant, if you go another 15, 20 minutes without scoring a goal, I do wonder if it might get just a little more anxious, you know, on the pitch and off the pitch as well.
Yeah, for sure. But speaking of anxiety, you know, I know we're talking about Brighton's defending not being great there. I think Arsenal deserve credit as well for the way they kind of fostered that anxiety in that back line. You know, yes, they made the mistake playing out from the back, but that's coming after 50 minutes of relentless pressure from Arsenal's forwards closing them down. And yes, obviously this comes from the corner immediately afterwards. So maybe that skittishness and nervousness from playing out the back, it carries through into the set piece and Arsenal capitalise. I do think that you wear defences down over time. And I think what we saw from Brighton at the start of this half was a defence that, you know, had started to be a bit worn down.
I think that's fair, but, you know, they still continue to defend really well. We had some moments, didn't we? I think Saka shot into the side netting. What else was there?
There was an
Odegaard shot.
White had a header cleared off the line.
Well, yeah, that came after a Martin Odegaard shot, which got Lewis Dunk right in the junk.
The ultimate cock block.
Yes. I thought his face was so funny, though, you know, because it was a classic of the, like, oh my God, I've been hitting the balls. This is so painful.
It was very, very funny, I think. I was at that end and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, a great block, and he really, you know, he put his a particular part of his body on the line for his team.
I mean, brilliant defending.
Sure.
But there could be no doubt as to where he got that when you see the replays.
Right in Dunk's junk.
Right in his junk. just looking at it here again. He's got two hands there.
He actually played on pretty swiftly after that. I was like, I think if that was me, I would have been subbed off. Like, just rolling around on the touchline for about 20 minutes.
Oh, we've all been there, in fairness. You know, get one of those on a cold day on a football pitch and it's just not much fun at all, I have to say. But his face was a picture. But look, to his immense credit, he got up and it was like literally 60 seconds.
Was it?
After that, where he headed the Ben White flick off the line. So,
brilliant,
you know,
clearance that as well.
Fair play.
And it looked a certain goal. You know, good delivery, the right header from Ben White.
Mm.
And those are the moments where this game might have, you know, been a much more comfortable scoreline.
Sure. I mean, there were other moments as well. There was a great, I think there's a really good save from Martin Odegaard.
Yeah, great save.
The one where I think he thought about his finish last week against Emi Martinez and decided to go high, and the keeper just put a big hand out and saved it. It was a very good save.
Poured it. Well, I think Odegaard basically scored that goal. Was it against Nottingham Forest last season where he just like punted it into the top corner?
Mm.
And yeah, I thought the way the goalie sort of clawed it out was quite impressive.
There was
Havertz
might
have scored with a header.
There was a header for Kai Havertz. And then I think the next big thing that happened was Brighton's one and only chance with the of the game when we just made a couple of subs. I think Trossard and Nketiah had come on, Jesus and Martinelli off, and they got down the right-hand side. I know there's quite a bit of speculation or discussion about Ben White, and maybe we'll save that for part two. But I think Saka looked a bit tired as well at that point, and Brighton were able to, for the first time, I think, really get in behind, put in a dangerous ball. Pascal Gross put it wide. I think he went with the wrong foot when you look at it again.
Well, thank God.
Yes. Thank goodness.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd seen me the moment that hit the side netting, for a start, from the other end of the North Bank, I think we all thought it was in.
Oh.
I looked like Lewis Dunk moments after he'd made that block, basically, in that second. It was real. It was not a good time to be me. But fortunately, I'm just watching it again. Yeah, he goes with the left. I mean, he goes with the wrong side of his foot.
Yeah,
really.
Maybe so. Yeah.
But it's very, 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 very close to being 1-1.
Yes. And look, these are the fine margins that exist in Premier League football. And I know that, you know, there'll be people there who will say, you know, by the time that chance was created, we should have been out of sight. And that's probably true. It is probably true. But, you know, unfortunately, football doesn't always work like that. And you have to ride your luck just a little bit. But, you know, from
Can I make a point on that?
Yeah.
Just to say that, you know, Brighton could create one chance in the game.
Mm.
And let's say they had a 50% chance of scoring from it. Arsenal created, I don't know, half a dozen decent chances. Like, on the balance of play, we would have been really unlucky if they had got a point here, in my opinion.
I agree. I agree. But, you know, it's another one of those where we would probably be saying, you've got to take your chances and you've paid the price. But, you know...
But if you create more chances than the opposition, then sort of, even though football is quite random and finishing can be a bit of a lottery, you're probably going to come out on top. If they'd had two or three like those, then I'd be here saying, like, we got away with one there. But... Yeah, I think if we'd been pegged back, it would have been a pretty cruel twist of fate. Although it can happen, you know.
Of course. You know, that is kind of how football works.
Yep.
But, you know, we responded very well, I think, to that moment where Brighton, I think on Match of the Day, they said something like, just when Brighton were beginning to get going. And it was like, no, they weren't beginning to get going at all. They had one moment. And, you know, after that, we had... the Declan Rice moment where he just drove down the left-hand side and you know, kept going and had a shot. Maybe he could have squared it for Eddie Nketiah, but I don't blame him then for having a go. And then, you know, a couple of minutes later, we get the second goal. I think this is quite a nice goal, actually. I enjoyed the way that Trossard kept the ball alive in midfield. Like, he could have played a pass earlier, but he kept possession and then played it forward to Odegaard to Eddie. Eddie played it to Havertz, and Havertz slots home to make it 2-0 and to seal the game. And I think, well, you can tell me, there must have been plenty of relief around you at that point, because I do think, you know, 1-0, it gets a bit scary. You've got 6 minutes of injury time. 2-0, it was always going to be the win. And I think, I won't say justice was done, but like, if Arsenal won that game 3 or 4-0, I don't think Brighton could have complained.
No, not at all. And there was relief, but there was a lot of joy as well, because I think people were really happy to see Kai Havertz have a kind of big moment in the Premier League at home. I know he scored, obviously, against Lens, was it, in the Champions League? But this was a really significant, meaningful goal. And he's got a great song. And so any excuse to sing it.
It sounded like it was, you know, really doing the rounds in the Emirates
in
yesterday.
A big way.
Yeah.
And listen, I have to take my hat off. I was sceptical of whether or not the lyrics made sense in the early days. Kai Havertz scores again, but I now can credit the foresight of those lyricists. They knew what was coming. And I think it's quite a good finish, you know. I think it's kind of nuts. Like, I think he manages to sort of put it through the keeper's legs. He goes under him, basically.
Does it go between the keeper's body and his arm? Is that not where it goes, rather than
his legs? Right? I don't know.
I think either way. I'm going to
watch it
here again.
Good pass from Eddie Nketiah as well.
Yes.
To give him his credit. Some real zip on that ball into Havertz, and took it in composed fashion. Thought he had another good all-round game. It's just great to see him scoring goals. You know, that is really what... I know there's more to his role than that, but that's where we hoped to see the difference this season.
Yeah.
You know, a player in that role who can be a real attacking threat. So for him to get another one is great. And yeah, from then on, it was kind of party atmosphere. You know, we are top of the league, etc.
Yeah, I mean, a win I think we absolutely deserved, to be honest. Could have been another one for Smith Rowe, who came on and shot straight at the keeper. But, you know, this was a win we really needed, because we had to bounce back because of what happened against Villa. And it's also a win we needed because, you know, our record against Brighton is such that, you know, you kind of have to put that right. And what I'd like to sort of focus on a little bit is a couple of players. Declan Rice, he's quite good, isn't he?
Yeah, he's all right.
He's all right. I mean, there was a lot of chatter pre-game that he was going to miss out because he'd been ill the night before.
Yeah.
And he puts in a performance like that in a game like this, clearly not 100%, right? Couldn't be 100%. And he plays as well as that. I think when we talk about quality in players, we focus a lot on their technical ability, on their tactical awareness, all those kinds of things. But I think there is an element of character to the best players that, you know, it's hard to quantify, obviously, but you have to talk about it. And I think that determination to be available for the team and to go out and play as well as he did yesterday was just unbelievable.
Yeah. This is going to sound absurd, but watching the game yesterday and watching his performance, I always felt like you shouldn't be allowed to buy players who are this good. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's midfield doping. Like, I think after so many years, I'm such a child of sort of the Wenger era and the stadium financing era that going out and buying the best midfielder in the league, a player of this quality, like it almost feels sort of transgressive to me.
Mm.
But don't get me wrong, I'm thoroughly enjoying it as well. And so are the guys who were sat behind me yesterday. I hope that they won't mind me saying this. I hope I'm not outing them or kink shaming, but those guys were, as the game wore on, the manner in which they discussed Declan Rice seemed to sort of become increasingly lusty.
The erotic adventures of Declan
Honestly,
Rice.
Honestly, like it was like at first they'd be like, "Oh, look at the power," you know, and they'd be like, look at his arms,
look at those thighs glistening,
look at those legs going, look at this, look at the muscles on the boy. By the end, these guys were fully in love with Declan Rice. And who can blame them?
Who can blame them?
I'm sure there's many out there who felt the same. He is a true bulldozer of a footballer, isn't he?
Mm, he's, well, I think bulldozer is doing him some disservice there. You know, that seems a bit destructive, if you like, a bulldozer. This guy is just, you know, the way he drove down the left-hand side that time and he sort of took a touch and then just, you know, it could have been Pascal Gross that he went beyond and Gross kind of just throws his arms out and goes, ah, fuck. You know, he just couldn't keep up with him. And This was the 85th minute in a game where Declan Rice has been up all night with God knows what, you know, feeling bad and on the toilet or whatever. Just sensational. He really is. I think we're running out of superlatives or running out of ways to describe him.
Well, yeah, he's the clear front runner for Footballer of the Year, I think. I think he's been the best player pretty much in the Premier League this season. Every game, I imagine a kind of parallel universe where Man City sign him and league is effectively a no contest. He was outstanding yesterday. He's been outstanding since he came in. People talk about that idea of like men against boys, but when you're watching Declan Rice, it does feel like that at times. His capacity to sort of gain ground on the opposition players. Again, I'm not trying to diminish the technical quality, which I think he's proven by now is absolutely there. But the physical dimension that he brings is extraordinary. It's like we're seeing a new evolution of athlete. It's like you've taken a sort of modern footballer and dumped him back in the early 90s. You know what I mean? The way he's able to just sort of blast past people. And the fact he's doing that against elite athletes, it's sort of astonishing.
Yeah. The intelligence with which he reads the game, I think, is unbelievable.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that must be the explanation. You know, is he actually 3 or 4 yards quicker than these people?
No, he's not.
Probably not.
No. No, but
so, you know, he's a 6'2" guy from Romford or whatever. But I think, yeah, mate, he's just absolutely killing it. Yeah. And I feel so lucky and like a tiny 1% guilty.
No guilt. We have him. No guilt whatsoever. Fuck them. You know, we had to do a lot of work to get him in and we paid a lot of money for him. And that money has been, you know, some of the some of the best money Arsenal have spent in recent times, even if it was an extraordinarily high amount of money. I think it stacks up against, you know, any of the best signings that we've made.
I've got one more Declan Rice thing, actually.
Go on, yeah.
I was thinking back yesterday to this time last year. So it was about, 12 months ago, almost exactly. Maybe it was during the World Cup. And a bit of a peek behind the sort of journalism curtain. The first I heard of this kind of prospective transfer was that someone, a good contact, said to me, "You're going to be excited." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Arsenal are pretty close to effectively securing the signing, or securing an agreement from a world-class player." And I was like, that's all I got.
Mm.
And I was like, is that going to be? And anyway, you make more calls, you know, you do a bit of digging. At the time, I was like, Bellingham? Is it Jude Bellingham, maybe? You ask around. Within a week or so, I managed to find out that he was Declan Rice. And I have to be completely honest and say that I think my first reaction was to go, oh, yeah, he's a good player. Is he world class? And I feel like now, a year on...
You idiot, James.
Yeah. I feel like I've had that question answered. And I feel like I need to go back to that guy and say... Yeah. You were bang on.
You were right. Yeah. I mean, I think probably something similar in terms of when I heard about it was towards the tail end of last year. And I remember being very excited by it because of the sort of the statement of the signing, but also the kind of player that he was. But he has so exceeded the expectations that I had for him. I can't really put it into words, to be honest. I thought he would be good. I thought he would be good for us. I thought he was going to be the perfect player for our midfield. But I just have been so impressed with everything that he's done since he's arrived. And he's just such an exciting, maybe not quite it, but there's just so much to enjoy about the way he plays and what he brings to the team and the consistency with which he plays as well is unreal. Because has he had a bad game for us?
I don't think so. Has he missed a game? Barely. Mm-hmm. Pray to all your gods. And I think as well, like we speak about the mental side, like the level of application, I don't just mean in terms of hard work, but in terms of learning and self-improvement.
Mm.
Second to none. You know, Declan Rice was always a talented player, but we shouldn't forget he's also a player who's released from Chelsea at 14. It wasn't as if he was always destined to be, you know, great or the second coming. He's a player who's had to really work hard and focus and learn about the game to get to where he's got. And that's why he came to Arsenal, because he wanted to learn more. And I know that those first few weeks and months for him were a huge adaptation process. Suddenly he was getting all this information from Arteta, from his staff, about new game models, new ways of thinking about the game. And he has grasped it so quickly and so wholly. I think it's hugely, hugely impressive, almost more impressive than someone who's just got God-given talent.
Yeah.
You know, I have huge admiration and respect for him as a person and as a professional, for how he is seeking to make the absolute best of the natural gifts that he's got.
Yeah. Yeah. And as we said, to do it, you know, on a day when he probably wasn't feeling 100%, I think that just speaks volumes about, you know, what kind of character he has on top of all the fantastic technical qualities that we've spoken about. Before we go into the break, can we just, give some flowers as well to Martin Odegaard, who was, I know we talked about that pass, but I just think when you've got Odegaard in that kind of mood and when you've got Gabriel Jesus in the kind of mood he was in, it's sort of impossible not to play well, you know, that these guys are so... oil in the engine players, if you want to call them that, that they sort of elevate the players around them. And when you consider the talent level of some of those players, you know, that's no mean feat, is it? Because, you know, the Saka, Martinelli, Havertz, Declan Rice, but Odegaard yesterday was just, he looks like he's back to his best, and, you know, the few little aches and strains and niggles that he was experiencing before that break he had are hopefully a thing of the past. This looks more like the Martin Odegaard that we all know and want to see perform on a weekly basis for Arsenal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And happy birthday to him as well.
Oh, it was his birthday, was it?
It was his birthday yesterday.
How old is he? 20.
And he celebrated with a brilliant performance, I thought.
How old is he?
How old is he?
25?
25, maybe? Let's have a look. Yeah,
25. Turn
25, exactly.
The big quarter century. Shame he didn't get a goal, but there you go. He was just... Still a very young man. All right. Well, look, will we call it quits on part one? I think we should.
I think so. I think I need to go and take a cold shower after all that Declan Rice chat.
All right.
I've got myself quite het up.
All right, well, you go de-moisten yourself, and we'll come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnerBlog and at ArseBlog. Also on the ArseBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArseBlog member on Patreon. Would you like to go first?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Let's go for this, because we've just spoken about Declan Rice and Martin Odegaard, but this was a bit of a different take. It's from Paul Jacobs. Paul says on Twitter, I was concerned after the final whistle whilst Rice and Odegaard were on their haunches looking absolutely knackered. I know they were both man of the match or men of the match, but it seemed more than just having emptied the tank. With the Christmas period coming, am I wrong to worry?
I think it's natural to worry when you see two of our best players looking absolutely knackered. But I do wonder if it was anything more than just being absolutely jacked after a, you know, incredible performances from both of them. You know, we talked about what Odegaard created, but, you know, he created a lot of that with real hard work. He's the guy who leads our press most of the time. You know, the amount of sprints he does. I'd love to be able to get those stats, actually. You know, how many sprints did he do in that game? So I wouldn't worry about it from that perspective. Like, I don't think they've done themselves any damage. I think they just worked really, really hard in a very, very difficult game. And at the end, were wrecked. And they'll go home and have a, you know, hopefully a day off and then come back. And we've got a full week before our next game. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
No, I think that's interesting that we've got the full week off. You know, you think of this time of year, and you're really accustomed to fixture congestion, playing every few days. We've got 6 days now between Brighton and Liverpool. I think that's pretty healthy, actually. And that is just an absolutely massive game, isn't it? I mean, that's the one thing I suppose we didn't really talk about in terms of the result is, I think, how important it was ahead of Anfield, which looks massive, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's going to be a huge game. And I know that, Liverpool weren't particularly impressive yesterday against Manchester United, despite the fact they had, 35 shots or something like that? 35 attempts on goal? Is that right?
Yeah, it was over 30, for sure.
It's crazy, you know, but it was such a low-quality game. We'll talk a bit more about that later on this afternoon over on Patreon in the 30. But I would expect our game against Liverpool to be quite different. You know, Manchester United-Liverpool is so often just a terrible game of football. You know, for all the anticipation and the rivalry between the two teams and the history and all the rest, it's just, bad a lot of the time. One of the most underwhelming games of the season, more often than not.
I'd agree with you.
But I don't expect that to be the case next weekend. I think it's going to be a very, very intense game. But, you know, we have set ourselves up pretty well for it. You know, going back to the top, playing as well as we did against Brighton. And, I think every aspect, every facet of our team is going to be tested next weekend against Liverpool. You know, defensively, the attack, we're going to have to be more efficient in attack if we go to Liverpool, because I don't think we're going to get 26 chances or 26 attempts on goal like we did yesterday. So I'm sure it's something they'll focus on during the week.
There's a lot on the line. The Christmases of millions of Arsenal fans are at stake.
What about this, though, from MC Godlike? I think that's what he's... I've really got to get new glasses. Yeah, MC Godlike. He says, am I alone in hoping we aren't top at Christmas? It seems to put a weird pressure on the season. I think you're probably alone there.
I think you're alone, mate.
Yeah, because that would mean...
If you go to Anfield and get battered, Christmas is cancelled in my house. I'll be there during my on-the-whistle video, setting fire to the presents.
What did we do for my first ever Christmas, Dad?
Well, I
destroyed the tree.
I shredded the tree and burnt all the presents.
And I went to a local orphanage and I just walked in the door and said, there's no such thing as Santa. That's what I did.
Yeah. I mean, that is a risk. So for that reason alone.
Yeah, I want
a result. I think top at Christmas... it's not like last season where Top of Christmas gave you sort of a month or so to bask in it, as I recall, because of the World Cup. This is going to be for potentially 4 days until we play on the 28th. Yeah. No Boxing Day game for Arsenal this year, which does feel a bit weird.
Yeah, it does. This is proper Christmas this time.
Yeah.
You know?
So I think it matters. I think it matters hugely in terms of the title race that we get a result there. I know that I was looking at Liverpool's games, actually, and they've got a pretty tricky run coming up, which started with Man United. Let me see if I can dig it out. So they've got a run of 7 league games, which include matches against United, Arsenal, Newcastle, Chelsea, and Arsenal again, away from home. So those are all fixtures in this 7-game Premier League run. And for quite a lot of that, they'll be without Mohamed Salah, who will be at AFCON.
Oh, AFCON, yeah.
So this is a crunch period for them. And they have to come to the Emirates twice in the space of a month, pretty much, once for the FA Cup and once in the league at the start of February. But if we could go to Anfield and get something, I think it'd really sort of consolidate our position. I think it'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think we're good enough. We're absolutely good enough.
Oh, for sure. You know,
it doesn't mean it'll be easy.
No. I mean, it's going to be a test. But then every game is a test. I think the Brighton game was an interesting test as well. You know, how do you respond to being beaten away from home? I think the response was excellent, and I think the response to losing to Newcastle was excellent. So those are, you know, nobody likes losing, nobody likes dropping points, but how do you react? You know, the conversation we used to have about Arteta's Arsenal, you lose 3 and then we get it back. Then you lose 2 in a row and you get it back. Maybe now we're seeing the evolution of that, you know, you're losing 1.
Well, yeah, I think so. And actually, on the subject of that kind of consistency, I saw a question on the Discord from Gautam Bhatia, who said, "Goodly morning, gents. Is this the first time since 03-04 and 04-05 that we've had two successive title charges two seasons in a row?"
I guess so.
I mean, my memory may be failing me here.
04-05, were we? I don't. Did Chelsea not win that by a fucking mile?
Yeah.
In that season?
Perhaps so.
I think they had like 90 odd points that year. I mean, we might have finished second.
Let's have a look.
We did finish second, but 12 points behind.
Yeah.
Chelsea, who finished with 95 points. We finished with 83 points.
Yeah, we had a good season, 83 points. You know, 125 games, but we weren't particularly close to Chelsea. Yeah, that was a record at the time, the 95 points that they won the league with. But yeah, I do think that is a good point. You know, I think we're used to periods where, you know, certainly in the sort of latter half of Wenger's reign, there'd be the odd season where we might find ourselves in the title hunt, but we were never really able to, I just use the word, but consolidate our position and go again. It certainly felt that way anyway. And the fact that we've done so in successive seasons under Arteta, I think, is testament to what he's building being somewhat more sustainable.
Sure, sure. Here's one from Chris Godfrey, who's at Chris P. Godfrey, Chris P. J. Godfrey on Twitter. He says, "How worried should we be about Ben White's form? With Matoma, he probably had the hardest defensive gig of the day. But even so, I don't think he gave the best account of himself. Judging by his own very high standards, he's had an underwhelming few weeks."
Yeah. Well, listen, I was in the stadium and I'll be completely honest and say it's not always the best kind of tactical viewpoint to be in the corner behind the goal. And I didn't come away from the game overly concerned about Ben White, but I'm very open to the idea that I missed something there. So what did you see through the TV pictures?
I saw Mitoma go past him once. Maybe I'm misremembering myself. You know,
he's one of the best dribblers in the league.
I thought Mitoma was pretty quiet, all things considered. You know how good he is. Mentioned Ferguson, mentioned Mitoma in the first half. You know, this is a guy who's skinned defenses time and time again. I don't think he did that yesterday. I will admit that because of the ludicrous rules around TV coverage, I had to watch on a stream, and it wasn't always the best stream in that, you know, you're having to go back and restart it or find a new one, and, you know, it's complete bollocks, isn't it, that in nearly 2024 we're having to scratch around on the internet to try and find, you know, a game of football that we want to watch when basically everybody else in the world can watch these games and watch every game. It's crazy that in the UK and in Ireland we have to, you know, we have to become pirates essentially to watch our football team. So maybe there's something I missed in little pockets of coverage that I didn't get. But beyond that moment where Mitoma went past him to create the chance for Pascal Gross, I thought Ben White did fine, to be honest. Maybe he's
I
not
that
quite
his
100%.
Maybe not at the level that it was last season. And I think if Takehiro Tomiyasu was fit, you know, I looked at starting 11 yesterday, I was like, is this Arteta's sort of, you know, first choice? Is this our best 11, as we're always asked about? Mm. And I was like, it's got to be pretty close. I think the only debate, really, for me at this stage would be about the right-back position or let's say, the full-back position. You know, maybe Tomiyasu would be in one of those full-back slots. But I think it's a pretty close fight between those three for those two places. So yeah, I think Ben White's form has dipped a little bit. I think he's in a difficult position at the moment where he's having to play a lot of games, a lot of minutes, and he's going to have to play a lot of minutes moving forward. So maybe a bit of fatigue is inevitable, but by and large, I thought he did all right up against Mitoma yesterday. As I say, it wasn't something I came out of the match worried about.
No, me neither. Me neither.
What about this? French Gooner says, "Goodly morning, guys. What do you think of Emile Smith-Rowe's latest short cameos? To me, during these few minutes, he seemed different than all his previous comebacks. Physically better, but also has played more vertically, more threatening with the ball, and just felt more confident.
Maybe. I need to see a bit more, you know?
Yeah.
He really hasn't had too many minutes. He did have that chance, which we referenced in the first half, and you know, maybe that's one he should score. I don't know if he should score. It's a good save again, to be honest. It's one of those that could have squirmed under the goalkeeper, and I think the positive aspect of that is that he was in the position he was in to, I think it was Trossard. Declan Rice did really well. He crossed it. Trossard nodded it back, and Smith Rowe was there to kind of get a shot on target.
It was another one of those moments where Rice just came and took the ball off the opposition, basically, as I recall.
And again, it was really like that could have been injury time, which again goes to everything that we were talking about with Declan Rice. You know, I honestly can't say. I need to see more of Emile Smith Rowe since he's come back from the injury, and I'm hopeful. I'm positive. We talked about him last week, didn't we? And you know, my belief that if he was a fully fit Emile Smith Rowe is somebody who will serve us really well over the course of the rest of this season. But the sample size in terms of what he's been given with minutes in the last couple of weeks is just too small. Like, I'm hopeful, but I can't say for sure that I've noticed anything markedly different at this point.
I have noticed a sort of directness and athleticism, and I think he has that knack, doesn't he, of sort of being able to come off the bench and be dangerous.
Yeah.
And already in this sort of brief comeback, there have been a couple of moments that might have been goals, which I'm encouraged by. I'm encouraged by, because I think we need that sort of impact player from the substitutes bench. But it's such early days that I'm still a bit tentative around it. But yeah, I'm pleased to see him back on the bench and just at least getting some minutes in his body. And
yeah,
let's hope he can sustain it and keep it going. You know, you always just fear what's the next piece of bad news around the corner with Emile. And I really hope that 2024 is a really productive, positive year for him.
Gray, who's at Wiggle That on Twitter, says, is Saliba the best passer we've ever had at centre-back? I thought he made some really eye-catching passes yesterday. If he's not, who is? And just before we do that, let me see if I can find this again. I was taken aback by the Arsenal passing statistics at halftime in this game. Here are outfield players' pass completion percentage. Ben White, 95. Gabriel, 96. Saliba, 98%. Zinchenko, 92%. Havertz, 100%. Odegaard, 92%. Declan Rice, 95%. Saka, 90%. Jesus, 100%. And Gabriel Martinelli, 93%. And when you consider, you know, some of the forward players often, and in particular wide players, you know, they can often have slightly lower pass completion percentages because they're trying more risky passes. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Those were the halftime stats. I didn't look at the full-time ones, but there you go.
That is amazing. And you know, a big focus of pre-season, apparently, was kind of slightly shifting the balance of the team to make Saliba the guy, like the central point who everything is played out through. And I think that's wise when you see his quality on the ball. Is he the best we've ever had? Very possibly. I mean, it's partly an evolution of the role, you know.
And the game. Game itself, yeah.
The demands on centre-halves were very different. You know, Sol Campbell was not of this kind of technical calibre, but he wasn't required to be. And actually, you know, Kolo Touré, when he came into the team, bear in mind, he came in as a guy who played left wing, up front, centre midfield, right back for Arsene. When he came in as a centre back, apart from his acceleration and power, what he really brought was a high level of technical quality, and everything played out through him. You know, his passing, his ability to carry the ball forwards, and that was quite advanced, really, for that era. So I think in his time, he was very good. But yeah, I think Saliba's got to be right up there. I honestly am struggling to think of anyone.
Yeah, same. I mean, look, we've had some very accomplished defenders, and you know, sometimes players are underrated, you know, based on what they do off the ball. But I think in the modern age, there is nobody quite like William Saliba, who finished the game with 98.5% pass accuracy from 65 passes. Wow. Against a team like Brighton.
Yeah,
that says something.
It's really exceptional. What about this question? So it's about our title credentials, I guess. Mm-hmm. So Chargui says, "Goodly morning, gents. Now reaching halfway point in the season, what has been the most valuable improvement of Arsenal compared to last season, in your opinion? Is it A, Declan Rice, B, quality depth, C, the collective ability to control games, or D, the more composed but still capable of scoring late winners mindset?" And then he says, "These are evidently intertwined, but which one will be more significant in helping us achieve our goals in your opinion?"
It's a good question. Quality.
Me, I think it's the collective ability to control games.
It's sort of that, or the depth that we have. Because, look, we're playing games without last season starting DM Thomas Partey. We don't have haven't had Emile Smith Rowe for most of the season. Gabriel Jesus, you know, was in and out at the start.
Tomiyasu as well.
No Tomiyasu. There was no Gabriel at the start of the season as well.
And I think Jurrien Timber.
No Jurrien Timber, exactly. So, you know, I think the depth thing has allowed us to cope better with absences. But obviously then that is intertwined with the way that we are deliberately trying to play football these days. It is different. Arteta said that, didn't he, last week or whatever. It's got to be different. You know, we want to improve, so it's got to be different. And I think there is a change in the way that we are playing. But I think what ultimately he wants to do is, like, would you say yesterday was a very controlled performance from Arsenal?
Yeah.
Right. I would too. But the discussion maybe 6 weeks ago was, the control has come at the cost of attacking efficiency or fluency, right? So I think the plan is to have the control, but also do what we did yesterday to Brighton, but be more efficient and score three or four or maybe five goals in a game. I think that's the plan. I don't think it was necessarily sacrificing attacking fluency or chance creation. I think it was a case of bedding in this idea of control and how we need to play, and then using that as a platform to attack. And
yes,
perhaps
and
yesterday,
in that period, we were without Gabriel Jesus, who I do think is kind of a transformative.
Yes. And Martin Odegaard not quite at his best form, as we've already discussed. So
yeah.
I think it's exciting, to be honest. I think it's really exciting to be able to do what we did yesterday. And look, yes, we should have scored more, but to sort of take Brighton apart in that way, you know, to make them defend in the last ditch manner with which they did, effectively at times. And, you know, you can talk about our own profligacy in certain moments, but I think it's exciting, to be perfectly honest.
I think it's interesting. Arteta, you know, he doesn't really use the word control. He wants to use the word dominance. Someone asked him a week or two ago about control. Is that sort of the difference, or is that what you're aspiring to? And he said, "No, I want to dominate in all aspects of the game." I suspect he feels that control, he's quite big on semantics, Arteta, and I suspect he feels maybe that's a bit passive, you know.
Yeah,
I think dominance fits more with his vision of his team and his football. But it's interesting, you know, while today we have absolutely waxed lyrical about some of the attacking play and some of the stuff we did going forward, and I think we're absolutely right to do that, I can't help but also look at the other side of it and think a team with all Brighton's attacking quality, the football they play, the record of scoring in consecutive games for the most part of a season's worth of football. And we limited them to effectively one chance in the game. And that, for me, at this point, is actually the story of our season. You know, the way in which we have kind of eliminated jeopardy, reduced the sense of risk within games, and exert that control. That for me is the dramatic shift in how we play. And the stuff that happens on top of that, you know, in the final third is necessary and exciting and brilliant. But I've got a feeling that it's what we're doing in our own half, or not in our own half.
Well, that's it. It's not in our own half. It's
keeping
about
keeping people away from our own half.
Exactly. Exactly.
That will be the difference. And I've said, I think Arsenal will win something this year, and I still think that.
All right. Well, I hope you're right. I have a question here from Pritch on the Discord. And he said, He said, to what extent do you think Arteta's apparent reluctance to throw youngsters in is down to the tactical complexity of his system? He mentioned today that it's taken until now for Kai Havertz and Declan Rice to start to understand fully what he wants. These are top-level pros. It's taken them months. Lacazette did an interview in France this week and mentioned how Arteta is the most tactically advanced manager he's worked with, arguably at a time when we were less sophisticated as a team. Surely chucking a 17-year-old into this side with very specific roles, periodization, and rotation is a massive ask. He said, I might be right, might be wrong, but I can say for sure that I'm much more intelligent than I was at 17. Is the challenge mental rather than physical or technical?
Well, it's a good point. We spoke about Declan Rice, and you know, I explained how he was almost overwhelmed by the sort of wealth of detail and instructions when he arrived at Arsenal, and he came from a modern Premier League club in West Ham, who have analysts and coaching staff. But I think arriving at Arsenal and working for Arteta, it is another level. And multiple players have experienced that and described their almost awe at the level of detail at times. And some grasp it better than others, and some grasp it quicker than others. I think it's no coincidence, for example, that Leandro Trossard walked into Arsenal and basically took to it like a duck to water, because he was coming out of a club in Brighton who have a very sophisticated game model.
Yeah.
And he's obviously an intelligent footballer who could grasp that. Now, to bring it round to the young players, I think it's an interesting point. What I suppose the counterpoint would be to say, if you've got a properly aligned, joined up club, then in theory, those young players should be sort of being educated in the principles of play from an early age. So it should be, by the time they reach the first team, kind of part of their education, almost second nature.
That is interesting, though, isn't it? Because, you know, there are clubs where there is a philosophy that runs right through the club from, you know, start to finish. And this is how we play as a club. This is how we play. I mean, to what extent do you think Arteta's technical approach to the game is replicated below him? And by below him, I mean at sort of underage levels.
Great question. And to be honest, it would be better to ask someone like Art, or someone who regularly watches the academy sides, because they would tell you that, you know, the degree to which it's in place. I would suggest, based on what I've seen, I've watched a couple of under-19s games, mainly the sort of Champions League games this season. I was just, there is still quite a gap in terms of the sort of identity of the teams. And it's that problem of, you've got coaches who, yes, they're part of a system, but they also want to achieve results in their own right with the players they've got available to them. So there's that tension always between player development and, you know, youth team success. You know, do you pay the formation or the style that's going to win you the FA Youth Cup, or the one that's going to produce best players for the first team? And what's best for your career as a young manager? The main thing I would say is that Arteta's not been at Arsenal that long, really, in real terms. So I think it's, 4 years now. It takes time for these principles to be properly established and filtered down, and for the likes of Arteta, Edu, Mertesacker to come to a really kind of aligned vision on how the academy sides need to play and what constitutes an Arsenal player. We've got to be getting there now, but yeah, maybe it's not quite perfect. I have to be honest and say, I don't know, but it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's a kind of top-down model, but it must take some time to truly put it all in place.
I do wonder how replicable it is, you know, further down, because the specificity with which Arteta sets up his team and all the rest of it, you know, there's got to be obviously a measure of joined up thinking. We know that that's the case because of the way the academy is set up with Per Mertesacker, and what Mertesacker is doing is trying to prepare players who are ready to make the step up. But I suppose it's probably about getting players integrated into first team training. We've seen, you know, young players train with the first team and get a little bit of
Skelly on the bench yesterday.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that might have been, you know, an injury thing as much as anything. I've got a question about that next, but yeah, I mean, I think there is just such a big gap between playing youth football and playing first team football, and there's a huge gap between youth football and playing first team football for a team that is as good as Arsenal right now and one that is going to challenge for the title.
Yeah, and you can't replicate the stakes. You just can't replicate. You can't replicate the environment. It's really hard, and you don't know how different personalities will react to that spotlight and that pressure. And that's a big part of it. You know, like the question said, if you think about who you were at 17, who you are at 25, for example, vastly different in terms of how you'll deal with different scenarios and different situations. It's an interesting debate, though, this one about Arteta and young players, and I suspect it will rumble on, because I don't think it's going to get any easier for them to get their opportunities.
No, as we often say, it's like the cream has got to rise to the top, you know, and there's also an element of good fortune sometimes in how and when a player can get an opportunity in a first team, not just for a game or a 15-minute cameo here and there, but on a regular basis, which is kind of what you need to establish yourself as somebody who's part of a first-team squad, you know?
Absolutely.
People say, we must go out and buy this player, that player, we've got to buy this player and that player, but at the same time say, we have to bring through young players as well. You do that then. You see how fucking easy it is.
Yeah.
You know? These are the demands on managers. They're external, of course, and I'm sure the decisions they make are you know, based on all the information, all the analysis that they have based on what the squad needs. But it is one of those, you know, weird things, like you've got to go out and get another striker, but we also have to give this 16-year-old a chance. And I don't quite know how that works.
And to be fair, I don't know when it was now, maybe a year or so ago, that Edu was appointed sporting director rather than technical director. And part of the purpose of that was to create this bridge, right, between academy and first team. Because technical director was technically a first team role, working alongside Arteta and the management. A sporting director, he's got a broader remit. And one of the reasons for that was to kind of create better links between women's side and the men's side, the academy and the senior side. So who knows, Emma? Maybe, hopefully, that work is happening in the background.
Yeah. Do you mind if I ask another one here?
Because you mentioned you had a question.
We do have some questions about strikers and January and all that kind of stuff. Fagan on the Discord says, is the Dominic Solanke rumour the most underwhelming striker link since Dean Sturridge was mooted as an Anelka replacement? Perhaps a little harsh on Dominic Solanke.
He's having a great season, to be fair. It wouldn't be my first choice, don't get me wrong, but He's playing very, very well.
But Decky Healy on Twitter, who's at Ecky Healy, says so many rumours of being linked with various strikers, Solanke, Osimhen, Tony, Watkins, just waiting for the inevitable Calvert-Lewin rumours. But can you rank which is the more important position we need right now? Centre-back, central midfield, he says CDM, so a defensive midfielder, and striker. If you had to rank those right now, what way would you do it?
Well, this is why January is always such an interesting window, because I think the priorities are so informed by what's happening on the pitch and the injuries, rather more so than kind of the broader picture of the squad. Like, I think if everyone was fit and available in the Arsenal squad, you'd give a different answer. You'd say, oh, could do with a forward maybe. But I think when you look at how thin we are in certain areas of the pitch and they are further back, you know, I'm thinking of the defence and maybe the defensive midfield. I think those take precedent almost at this point in time.
So
I would say... listen, if I was answering right now, bear in mind I don't know how significant Jorginho's injury is. I think I would go... I think I would maybe go defensive midfield, you know.
I think I would too. You talked about Miles Lewis-Skelly being on the bench yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, that's because Declan Rice is the only central midfielder that we have fit, right? Because Jorginho's got a foot injury. I don't know how long it's going to be. And then he's got a hamstring injury. I don't know how long it's going to be. And look, he's a great guy, but, you know... I think he's somebody that we, you know, will be moving on from sooner rather than later, given his contract status and all the rest of it. Partey, no idea if and when he's going to be back, how long he'll be back if he does come back, and then he's going to be off at AFCON as well. So I'm sort of ready to move on from Thomas Partey, to be perfectly honest, and... I have real worries about the center of midfield. So I think, as you said, if you're asking me right now, I think striker would be like last on the list.
Yeah, for me, that's way down the list right now.
You know, of the three, that would be last. Central midfield, probably first, and then center back. Because, you know, we do have Tomiyasu hopefully coming back. I know he's going to Asian Cup as well, which is a bit of a blow, all right. But, I mean, I've seen talk about Italian clubs being interested in Kivior. I just can't see how that's in any way possible in January, given the state of the squad right now. But
totally. I think even Cedric, you know, I think they'll be loath to let him go, which tells you, I think, how thin we are.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So
and, I'll even throw this in the mix. I would, you know, in a sort of fancy world where we're making three or four signings, I would prioritise a wide player over a centre forward.
So would I.
So centre forward for me, while I completely accept it's on the shopping list, and I think it is probably the next kind of big step in terms of squad evolution, I think in terms of depth and immediacy and getting through this season, I think it's way down the list.
Does a centre forward, though, allow you maybe to use Gabriel Jesus as the wide player?
True. But then, maybe. You know, I think Arteta, as we sort of said earlier, he thinks in terms of seasons. And I think the style of play that we have got for this season is built partly around Jesus up front.
Mm.
He might revise that in the summer. He might buy a pure number nine and turn Jesus into a winger or relegate him to the bench. Or, you know, we don't know. But I think when he thinks about 23-24 this year, I think this is the model of play. And I don't think he'll disrupt that in a big way halfway through the
season.
That's
really interesting, though, you know, that he thinks in seasons, that this is, there's got to be a consistency, if you like, I guess if it doesn't work, you know, if you're thinking in seasons and something isn't working, maybe you get to January and say, okay, sure, we need to pivot in a different direction. But when it is working...
Though, but we're top of the league.
Yes, I had noticed that, yes.
I know. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
Listen, I've got this quick one. I'm sure you'll do it in more detail on the 30, but I couldn't resist. Speckled Jim said, who won the dickhead world title, Martinez or Mope? Have you seen this?
Yes. It was a lot of fun, actually, I have to say. A lot of fun. I can't believe that Emi Martinez did not get booked.
No. What, for dragging Mope up by his collar?
Well, first for not... Well, Mope got booked for leaving the shoulder on Martinez, right?
Did he? When Martinez went to ground very...
Yeah,
easily.
Exactly. When he went down like a sack of spuds. And Martinez pushed Mope. He gave him a little... Like, it was exaggerated, of course, from Mope. But he didn't get booked for that. Nor did he get booked for, like, literally trying to drag him off the ground. You could see Mope just sort of dead weighting. That was the funniest part, just sort of dead weight. How much did you roll your eyes to heaven when, was it Kamara got sent off?
Yeah.
And they went, oh, you can't raise your hands. That's a red card.
I know.
I was like, oh, God. Do we have to? But who won? I think it's a draw. And I think we need to set the two of them on each other again. Maybe, I don't know, put them in an octagon, give them both a chainsaw and a dose of PCP and see who comes out on top.
Yeah. I mean, I think in an octagon, I'd have good money on Emi Martinez potentially killing Neil Mope. So, yeah, sure, let's do it.
Let's do it. Seems like a good one to me.
Yeah.
Right, final one from me. Oh, here it is. Yeah. The other Andy Murray, so not the famous Andy Murray, I guess there's one more
player. Yeah.
He says, just noticed that Kai Havertz tops the charts for Arsenal's yellow cards. Is he the new Granit Xhaka?
Or the successor to Mikel Arteta, who's racking up a few.
Yeah, four each. Arteta has more bookings than every other Arsenal player apart from Kai Havertz.
Is he on a ban? If he gets one more, or is he over the...
How many do you have
now?
To go now? Because for players, it's like 5 and then 10. So if it's for a manager, I presume it's 3 and 6?
Oh, sorry, but I mean for...
Havertz. Yeah,
one more. How many games has he got to go? He's got to get to the halfway point before which would be 19 games. A couple more. I mean, look, it's good we've got him for Anfield. Yeah, I guess he is the new Granit Xhaka. I guess he is, after all. After all that.
It has come to pass.
It has come to pass. Lo, and lo, it has come to pass that Kai Havertz became the new Granit Xhaka.
Yeah, I think it is the halfway point, isn't it, where your threshold is increased. So,
yeah. Listen, he's taken over the hard work, the yellow cards, the being the subject of intense debate. Mm-hmm. Now some of the goal scoring from last season.
He's got a better song.
He's got a better song, yeah.
He's got a better
That's the
song.
Real improvement we've paid for.
All right. Well, look, let's leave it there. Let's get this podcast out to everybody. As ever, thank you very much indeed for listening. We will have a special bonus Christmas Eve edition of the Arsecast Extra for you, because we are playing Liverpool on the 23rd. We will do something for you on Christmas Eve. That's how dedicated we are to sharing the joy of being top at Christmas with you guys. So please do.
Unless we lose, in which case it won't be Christmas Eve, because I'll have cancelled Christmas.
Yeah, you'll be outside that orphanage just telling the kids that there's no such thing as Santa. All right, well, we'll have more for you during the week, of course, as well. We'll have the 30 for you over on Patreon later this afternoon, discussing all the weekend's Premier League action. Plenty to get into there. Patreon.com/arseblog. For now, take it easy, folks, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.